Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am super excited to have with me Anthony Rose. Anthony is co-founder and CEO at Seed Legals, a legal tech platform that lets startups and investors complete the legals needed to build, grow, and fund their business at a fraction of the cost of using a law firm. With two exits, including Six Tribes and Beamly, Anthony's career has included 3D graphics, P2P music, internet video, social TV, and online communities. Known as the man behind the BBC iPlayer, Anthony ran the iPlayer and other BBC services from 2007 to 2010, taking the iPlayer from pre-launch to major success story. His patent portfolio includes patents for distributed online rewards, content discovery, and interactive television. Anthony, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me on the program. I'm hugely excited. This is going to be a lot of fun. All right.
For sure. Let's dive straight in. Recently, we learned that more than one in six of all early stage funding rounds in the UK are now done on Seed Legals. And that's according to Crunchbase. According to Crunchbase, there was 2.8 billion in seed and pre-seed angel grant and non-equity financing last year in 2021. So even if that number were to be discounted quite significantly, that's a lot of cash being closed through the platform. I'd really love to understand from you why you think Seed Legals is such a compelling platform for early stage founders.
So great point. And by the way, you know, the funding scene is dominated by large numbers of early stage rounds with companies raising a few hundred thousand pounds or a few million pounds with SEIS and EIS, and then a small number of massive rounds with companies raising hundreds of millions. So we don't have that big a market share of the 2.8 billion, but we have a lot of market share of companies in general. So of course, once they get to later stage, it eventually gets onto the London Stock Exchange or somewhere else. But why do we have such a growing market share? Well, I think the answer is, I like to think, what would a law firm do? And then we'll do completely the opposite. So when we started Seed Legals, my perception is people are looking for legals. And I've learned no one's actually looking for legals. You never wake up in the morning and go, I'm looking for a legal document. What you do say is, I want to hire a team member, or I want to get some investment, or I need to do something to run my business. And yet everything that we do, I mean, apart from joking that I like to rethink the opposite of a law firm, can you have an always on 24/7 platform? So on a rainy Sunday afternoon, through Slack integration, I see, you know, companies raising tens, 15, 20, 100,000 pounds with our Seedfast products when you just wouldn't have any other way. I like to rethink the billing model. So unlimited help and support. There's no meter that ticks. You pay for a product and you get unlimited support around this. And then it's also about the market intelligence. So when you go to a lawyer, they probably do a round a month and each one of them is an island. And my goal is to take all the data and show you what you should do, what's market. Are you the only schmuck who's agreeing to this deal term, or is everyone else agreeing to it and you'd be an idiot if you didn't agree to it? So in fact, it turns out that it's really the commercial advice and the dealing in deal terms in a sort of person-to-person, plain English way of working. As the investor, do you want a board seat? Do you want this? And then the computer will build everything from that. And today, the goal is just to build the same legal docs you would have gotten, you know, in the past. But in the future, you imagine that now being smart contracts and rapid fire trading. But that will come in the future. But today, it's to transform the entire workflow. So yes.
I think that's really an important point to kind of draw. And I'll give some personal experience here. So firstly, for our listeners, SEIS and EIS, that's the Seed Enterprise Investment Scheme and the Enterprise Investment Scheme that HMRC provides here in the UK, which is really incredible tax efficient investing for early stage businesses or for the investors in early stage businesses or individuals. I find it incredible that other countries haven't yet jumped on that bandwagon in the same way, because I think it's an incredible asset to the ecosystem. But from a personal experience, I actually remember going out to HMRC to get what is called advanced assurance, which a lot of our listeners will no doubt be aware of, which is basically the process by which you go to HMRC and say, look, I'm planning on building a business, launching a business, I'm planning on raising some investment. I'd like to give my investors comfort that this tax efficient kind of vehicle is going to be available for them. Can you give us a letter that says, yep, on the basis of everything we've seen, you know, we think we'll be able to grant that SEIS or EIS efficiency to those investors when they do invest. And the interesting thing is, you know, I'm a CFO. I work across a number of early stage businesses. It's not my first rodeo, but that process is really, really mind-numbingly painstaking. And there are lots of pitfalls because the guidance, certainly from HMRC, is vague to say the least, right? And I think one of the things I've seen a lot of founders and even kind of advisors benefit from is, hey, listen, look, if you're looking for advanced assurance, just go to Seed Legals because they've got that process effectively mapped out and they can tell you exactly what you need. And I think what it comes down to for all businesses is how do you do things better, faster, cheaper, right? And if I can not waste a week of my time trying to pull together documents, I can, you know, pay a certain amount to Seed Legals and get that work process done and hopefully a better than average chance of getting it through HMRC, then it's a no-brainer. I think for me that's what's really compelling.
Exactly. So thank you for that. So now on advanced assurances, more than 1 in 3 of all of them in the UK is now done on Seed Legals. So the process we've created is clearly working. And the thing with the HMRC site is there's a bunch of stuff they tell you, but there's a bunch of stuff that's not really mentioned, like that you need to raise or show indicated at least 25% of the amount you want to get advanced assurance for in indicated investment. Otherwise, they'll tell you to come back later. And then there's a risk to capital condition. So what's been happening over the past years, as the scheme has gained popularity, people have begun to waste HMRC's time with speculative applications. So they've raised the bar to make it a bit harder. And that's sometimes the noise in between. And that's the process that we've got super slick. We must do about 10 a day. And HMRC, for its part, is brilliant. They've been approving them sometimes in 2 or 3 days. So the mean time to approve is less than a week, which is fantastic in helping companies grow faster.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, right? It's both HMRC having someone trusted, you know, that they know are doing things in the way that they like them being done. And therefore, they, you know, it almost adds an extra checkpoint to their list, right? Of like, oh, okay, this has come through Seed Legals. It's going to have gone through the process that we like them to go through. And therefore, you know, the chances of us approving are that much higher. Anthony, there's a reason I call this podcast Nothing Ventured. And it really stems from, for me, at the very least, this love of experimentation, and to use an Aussie term, and I know you have some affection for Australia, having a fair go. I'd love to understand the sort of challenges you face, and I can imagine there's quite a few of these, when you've taken risk and how your attitude has changed maybe over time. It'd be really super interesting to understand that.
Great question. So I think the journey of a founder usually goes something like this. You've got a steady day job. You're doing something else for a living. You're earning a living. You can get home to your spouse and go, you know, the rent can be paid this month. And then one day you come back and you go, honey, I'm noodling over some crazy idea. And your partner goes, yeah, that's fine. Keep noodling. And then one day you go, actually, I'm thinking of giving up my day job to do it. So at that point, the first thing is there's the mind the gap moment, which is, can you dabble on the side? And thing one that I've learned myself, and I consistently see when I look at many pitch decks, is people think the difficult thing in a startup is building whatever it is. But actually, that's in retrospect quite easy. Yes, you put work into it and some months goes by and it's a pain. But the problem really is getting people to want it. And so the first thing is to validate before you jump and give up your day job, is to work out that people really, as far as you can, will want what you're building. And for this, I recommend The Mom Test, a great little book. It's like £10 on Amazon. It's called The Mom Test because you'll ask your mother, is it a good idea? And your mother will say, my son is so clever. Of course, it's a great idea. But your mother is totally not the blockchain audience and knows nothing about drones or whatever it is. And the trick is to find real users and ask them real questions. So that's thing number one. And as a sort of serial founder, you get to replay that discussion and that thinking periodically. The next thing is you start a company. At that point, in retrospect, it becomes clearer. It's kind of binary, which is you have this idea and either it's going to get product market fit and begin to take off, or you're going to struggle and it's not. And eventually you may need to sell or whatever it might be. But the first challenge is all about this one idea and to make it fly or not. But I think what's really interesting is when you have got that product market fit and you have got revenue and your business may even be profitable, then you've got an altogether different set of challenges, which is, do you never innovate again because you just keep improving efficiency? Hey, people are buying this product. Why spend more? Do you place small bets and go, well, we'll move into adjacent markets and we'll sell more to our existing customers? Or do you start placing really big, maybe crazy bets? Yeah, we're going to get onto the blockchain and move into Albania and whatever it might be. So if you bet the farm on something, it could be a fantastic bet, but you might spoil everything. If you place smaller bets, that's great, but maybe they're not ambitious enough. And if you don't place any bets, life is easy, but one day for sure, you're going to wake up and see someone's eaten your lunch, and the people that you were disrupting, you're going to find yourself as the one now being disrupted by somebody else. So that, for me, you know, we're fortunate with Seed Legals that we've got product market fit, that we've got a growing business, that people buy and love the things we do. But now the big question, which you can play out in a sort of slightly more luxurious way, right? When you are funding the business yourself and it doesn't have product market fit, and you're not sure if adding another feature is what's going to do it, or should you pivot and it's never going to work? You go through these, you know, hot, cold moments, the sweaty waking up in the middle of the night going, oh my God, it seemed like a fantastic idea, but no one actually is going to want this. Whatever came over me. And then you can't talk to your team in the morning going, team, bad news. All the stuff we've been working on for the last 6 months, I've had this epiphany overnight. It's rubbish. So you can't exactly do that. But once you have fortunately got that product market fit, you now, with time on your side, can start thinking about which things to do. And there, that's the challenge space that I'm in right now. And my colleagues with Seed Legals, what are the next things to do? Do you place big bets, medium bets, or no bets? So that's a fun gamification of what to do next.
I think there's a bunch of stuff to unpick there. Firstly, this won't be the first time my mother's gotten a mention on the podcast. It's taken her a while to figure out what I do. I don't think she has quite yet. She's enjoying listening to the podcast. I've got no doubt she'll enjoy this one as well. But I think that point around getting validation is massively important. One of the something I said on Twitter yesterday, and I'm not brilliant at Twitter, but I try. But I responded to a post saying, you know, what's best advice for first-time founders? And I wrote, distribution beats product every time. And I think what I mean by that is, if you don't have a place to sell your product or people that want to buy your product, building a product is absolutely pointless, right? So to your point, you've got to get that validation. You've got to have the people out there that are willing to kind of come and back you. And the second thing that you said that I think, again, I'd almost flip and it resonates again a lot with me is, at what point do you bet the farm? At what point do you put blockchain on your deck or artificial intelligence or whatever it might be? And what I tend to see is a lot of founders having it on their day one as if it's already been built, or as if it's something that is imminent, right? And that to me is almost a red flag that, okay, you haven't actually thought this through, because by the time you're in a place where blockchain or AI or Web3 or whatever the buzzword of the moment, you know, is actually viable for your business, things may already have changed. In fact, I saw one yesterday that said it was looking to kind of put blockchain into a product in year 3 to 7. I was like, you know, a lot is going to happen between now and 3 years from now. I think that's really interesting. And so it sounds like your personal attitude to kind of risk has become both, I would say, it sounds like it's become, you've become more understanding of what risks you're taking and therefore are able to gut check those risks much better maybe than you could, let's say, 20 years ago. Would that be fair to say?
I think so. I think the start point of a company is the major bet. And after that, maybe you think about it as playing a game of roulette. You can put some money on 26 red, but you wouldn't want to bet everything on 26 red because it's unlikely to come up. I mean, you'd only do that if you know, everything else was completely a mess and that was the last hurrah. Otherwise, you're going to place things on red or black and you're going to spread some things and you're going to take some larger bets. So that might be a way of doing it. By the way, just on the point previously about companies looking to do a range of things, I think what happens with founders is they've got a seemingly simple idea, and they think they're going to impress investors by doing more. So in their slide deck, you're doing a B2C proposition, and we're going to have B2B with APIs, and then we're going to have sell data, and we're going to do it on the blockchain. And you think that doing more is going to be more impressive. And to a naive investor, that may be the case. But to an astute investor, it is a big red flag. And when I see companies doing that, I say to them, that's amazing. How many people do you have in your dev team? And if they go 100, then I go, that's fantastic. And if they go 3, then I go, it's not really going to work, because you're doing all these things and your competitors who just doing one of them can focus all of their firepower on that. You'll just never ship these, and you'll run out of money before you do. So what I like to suggest is that between you and your developers and your customers, you laser focus on just the simple proposition that your customers will want. But actually, you've got two goals. You've got one goal is to sell something or provide something to your users, and another to get money from investors. So if you can clearly separate in your pitch deck, this is what we're doing on day one, and now this is our vision. Because investors, particularly VCs, want every investment to be a unicorn. They want to see $1 trillion or $1 billion opportunity. If it sounds too simple, they might go, that's great, you've got a fantastic hobby business, but it's not for us. So you need to show much more upside, but you must never conflate the two in your head and drink too much of your own Kool-Aid. This one is clearly the vision. I'm going to deliver this one first, the simple proposition. And when I've got users who are buying it and I've got revenue, I'm now going to use that and the growth to fuel the next set of things to do.
For sure. I mean, we see it a lot building models as CFOs and even the tech that I'm building at the moment, that almost need to layer in revenue stream after revenue stream to kind of show, use the word ambition earlier, to show that ambition. But actually, it's not that, having multiple services or multiple product lines is ambitious. It's are you being ambitious enough with that one focus product and idea that you kind of launch with? And I think it is an easy mistake to make for a lot of founders when they've not been in business too long, or it is their first time founding a business, as it is for most people, I would say. Not most people are not fortunate enough to have been multiple founders already in their lives. And it's a very easy mistake to make, because often they're coming out of big corporations which do have multiple product lines. And obviously they see that, they see that layering of revenue streams and potentially even cross-fertilization. But to your point, if you've got limited capital and limited team, you need to be laser focused. So just moving on to one of the other products actually at Seed Legal. I mean, like, data suggests, I think almost a doubling, if not more than a doubling, of seed stage dollars being invested from 2020 through to 2021 in the UK. What do you think that is being driven by? And the product at Seed Legal is agile funding, which I think is something that you guys have termed or given the term to. How does agile funding help unlock capital? And what indeed is it?
All right. So great points. And I joke that when we started Seed Legal, my goal was to help you do a funding round. And now my goal is to help you not do a funding round. So what do I mean? Well, funding rounds used to be painful and expensive, and actually they largely still are. You have to find investors. You have to figure out how much you need for the next 18 months. Then you have to raise all of that money. And worst of it, you're raising it at today's valuation. So you're giving away a lot more equity to raise money that in a year's time, your valuation may be much higher. So you're going to spend months courting investors. There's a catch-22 problem, which is every investor only wants to invest once someone else is committed to invest. So you're going around waiting for the first one to commit. And all this time, either your business is on hold, or as the founders, you're funding it yourself, which is fine, but obviously limits the rate at which you can grow. At some point, you're going to get home to your spouse and you have to explain where that $5,000 or $10,000 a month is going that's missing from the account. And questions will eventually be asked. So you do want to get some investment, but you don't literally need £300,000 today. If you just had £30,000 today, you could then pay this month's bills and get your developers and have enough that you can tempt somebody to give up their day job and work for you. You can't do it on a wing and a prayer. You need to have some cash in the bank. So what if you could raise a bit before a round, and then you could do a round, but in the round, firstly, you often don't get the full amount that you're looking for, or once you've got TechCrunch to write it up, or you've got some PR about you've closed your round, that's the point. Suddenly all the investors come to you. Can you top up the round without having to do a new one? So putting these pieces together, I call it agile fundraising. And once upon a time, what investors might have thought about as drip feeding was seen by investors as a failure of founders, maybe like a kind of a test. If you can't do a round, then you're out. But that's, in my view, wrong. And what we should do is turn a negative into a positive and explain to an investor, you're much better off raising a small amount to get you to the next step so you can get going now rather than spending months on the funding trail. And so what you can do is on Seed Legals, you can create a seed fast, which is what's called an advanced subscription agreement. So once upon a time, and well, there still is a convertible note. The investor gives you money now, and it could get converted into shares later or could get repaid later. There are two problems with a convertible note. One, there's no good signing up for something that has the investor repaid unless you have a profitable business. Otherwise, you're bankrupt. So don't do that. And the second thing is that with a convertible note, it doesn't qualify for SEIS and EIS. So the UK startup scene is fueled by those tax deductions, which are amazing and de-risk it for investors. So there's a clever new construct called an advanced subscription agreement. We have our own branding for it. We call it a seed fast, and they're insanely popular. And that's on the rainy Sunday afternoon when my Slack integration shows somebody's just gone and raised 5K, 20K, 50K or more through things that they could never do in the past. So the idea is investor gives you money now, it will convert into shares when you do your funding round. So now you're buying yourself some time to build the business, increase the valuation, solve often the who's in first problem, because the first person can be a smaller one. You can do the domino piece. And then when you do a round, afterwards, you've now got traction. You want to go out and raise more. And instead of going through the whole thing of getting everyone to sign up for another funding round again, you can use what we call instant investment, which is for the technically minded. It's a deed of adherence that joins new investors to the last round. But here's the wonderful thing. You can keep increasing the valuation. So you can essentially raise smaller amounts, top up. So you're giving away less equity overall than having to round up everyone, and you're getting on with your business sooner.
So again, lots to unpick there. I mean, I think back in the day, we'd have called that a rolling close, but effectively it's the same thing. I think the big difference is, or not the big difference, the big unlock that I think, again, C-Legals maybe gives to ventures and investors in this is the speed, right? And the lack of necessity for someone to be all over the paperwork, which, as you and I both know, when you're dealing with multiple investors, can be really, really painful if you are doing it by hand on your own or potentially via a law firm, but more likely the founder is doing it. Maybe they've got some accountant that's on board. They may even have engaged, my business for some of those services. But let's face it, if you've got 30 aces to get sent out alongside deeds of adherence, alongside subscription agreements, alongside making sure they send the money, it can be really painful. And I've just been through a transaction on Seed Legals where I've invested in a startup using the Seed Fast, and it was seamless. It was a very, very easy to execute document. And certainly, I think from the founder's perspective, that has allowed him to focus on getting the traction that he wanted. I wasn't aware of the instant investment product, and that sounds like a great addition. Again, it just makes life easier. You're not opening up a new round. You're just coming in on the same terms as the last one with the same shareholders agreement, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's really, again, it just lowers friction both for the investor as well as for the company that's raising investment. Where do you think all the money's coming from at the moment, Anthony? I think that's one of the things that has been quite shocking. I mean, we do know obviously about the free cash, quote unquote, that has been thrown out there by governments during the pandemic. But is it just that, or is it something else? What do you think you're seeing at the moment?
Great question. Well, I think there are probably, you might divide it into three and maybe four sources of cash. One of them is angel investors with relatively small investments. Number two are UK VC funds. Number three are foreign investors. And maybe number four is crypto. So let's go through them each. So angel investors, you can earn 0% from your bank. So if you do have some cash that you might want to take a small bet on or a bigger bet, depending on the amounts. And I think that's the fascinating thing, which is, were you, thanks to the democratization of funding and the rise of crowdfunding and so on, you can make smaller bets. And you might want to bet because because you want a return on capital and you think there's a huge profit to be made. You might do it because you want to help that company. You might do it for the lifestyle, so you're going to hang out. You might do it to tell your friends. There are many reasons why you invest. And if it's £5,000, the bar doesn't have to be that high. If it's £50,000, it's more. And that's where your tax deductions come in. But there are billions of people in the UK who could be angel investors from, a modest amount upwards. The next thing are funds. And funds raise big amounts of money and they have to spend it. The fund can't go, hey, investors, called LPs, who've given the fund their money to invest, they can't say to those investors, we're just going to sit on it and wait. The investor's going to say, that's no good. I'd have just given it to the bank or played the market myself. So the fund has to invest. And there's enormous amounts of money sloshing around looking for the hottest startups to invest in. And that amount seems to be growing exponentially. The next thing is foreign investors. And there, in the past, you know, legals are local and it's hard to find other companies in other countries. But I think that globalization is happening quite rapidly. And one of the wonderful things on Seed Legals is the deal terms are shown in the interface. So you can be anywhere in the world and you can see I'm getting a board seat, I've got these consent rights. And if the company's in France, it's all in French, but you can read the terms in English. So we want to create this global framework that makes investing anywhere as really as easy as investing in your own country. And I think we're seeing the rise of more foreign investment. So there's lots of money in the Middle East, Singapore, Hong Kong, the US, and about 20% of funding rounds in the UK we now see have foreign investment. And it's quite interesting because those foreign investors are often used to slightly different deal terms in their home countries. They'll want preference shares and other things that are not common in the UK. And there's equally large amounts of money there. And particularly the US ones are now looking to Europe where valuations are a lot less and they see potentially new rich pickings. So if you can tap into that, that's fantastic. And then the last thing is huge amounts of money in crypto that's looking for new things to invest in. And it's something that's quite interesting. We don't currently support crypto investment, but I'm looking to make it a one-click option on Seed Legal's platform. So you can say, I'd like my, you know, in the Shells agreement, I'm going to put both my Barclays account and my ETH wallet address, and you can send money in whatever fiat or crypto as you like, or you might do a crypto-only round. So some of these things need somewhat more legal review, codification, but I'm looking to make those a one click. And I think that will open up a new untapped area into a new, you know, into startup fundraising.
I think those are spot on. Interestingly, the point about angel investment, I think, is one that at the moment is becoming more and more understood. I think, to your point, the democratization of access, whether it's crowdfunding, whether it's platforms like Seed Legals, or whether it is people like me who are quite heavily and intimately involved in the startup ecosystem, but don't necessarily have huge amounts of liquidity because we're building our own startups or whatever it might be, are able to put, you know, smaller amounts into these rounds. And I think one of the things that founders are starting to appreciate is that, you know, having a chip on their shoulder type angel who has been there, done that, is an operator at heart, understands, you know, how to build what the ecosystem needs, like how to go to market, etc., is really valuable. And therefore, they're also willing to take on those smaller checks, whereas in the past, maybe they wouldn't have been able to. And I think you and I had a bit of a debate about this, again, maybe on Twitter, I might be wrong, around, you know, why the need for syndication as an example, if, you know, today it's so easy to just one click and bring in a smaller investor. Syndication, I think, does something different, and it's probably more valuable for the investor than it is necessarily for the founder.
So for those who may not be aware, there's a growing trend that groups of investors may get together and invest as a group. And the way it will often work is the founder reaches out to an investor, and you've got an angel investor who goes, you guys are awesome, I love what you're doing, you're looking to raise 200K, I can't invest 200K, I'd like to invest 30K, but let me call some friends and see if they can invest too. And this can range from a hobby, you ring around and call some friends and you do intros, or the investor might go, I tell you what, I'm going to arrange some friends to come with me, but then I'd like you to give me something for doing it. It could be some cash or some shares, or often what's called a carry. So when you sell the company, I get some money back first for my efforts. So what's quite interesting with syndicates is that as a founder, it's hard work finding investors. But if you can empower investors to find other investors, that's interesting. And so if you look at the development of funding, once upon a time, there was no equity. You had to go to the bank and borrow money. And the bank would never lend money to a high-risk startup that didn't have revenue to repay the loan. So that was no good. Then VCs came along and they would invest. But the only time a VC would invest is when you were later stage and you had millions in revenue. So you could still never get started. And then the pendulum swung all the way the other way to crowd rounds, and you could have 1,000 investors at £100 each, requiring essentially no consent rights, no information rights. I mean, for 100 quid, it's like a nice dinner. You know, you don't need to worry too much about your money. It's you're taking a fun lifestyle bet. But it's hard work to find all of those investors. You have to be able to play the crowd and so on. And so then the next step, which is really Seed Legal's area, is angel investors, people, you know, investing 5,000 to 100,000 pounds, companies raising 100,000 to a million, and now increasingly A rounds as well. But of course, the wonderful thing is things are always evolving. And the next piece might well be the rise of syndicates, people investing collectively, might be the rise of token offerings in rounds, NFTs linked to cap tables. Who knows what comes next? And, you know, you can probably assume we're dabbling in some of these. I'm not sure how far we are in some of them, but, you know, we'll see. Those would be some of my larger but smaller dollar bets that I would be thinking about.
Well, interestingly, we have Patrick Ryan, one of the founders of Odin, which is a syndication platform, coming on the podcast later this week. So I shall be sure to ask him many, many questions. I think, as you say, I think there's huge value to outsourcing that fundraising process from the investors that are most keen on coming into your business, because they are going to be, you know, wanting to, I use this word without any legal sort of sense behind it, but they are going to want to promote the investment that they are making, in the sense that they are going to want to tell their friends they are making an investment in this great business. And, you know, if you, friend number one, has the ability to make an investment as well, why don't you come along aside me? And that, you know, that social proof, and you talked about it earlier, you know, that herd animal kind of mentality and the fear of missing out is very powerful, right? And if a friend says, hey, listen, I'm coming into this hot new thing, why don't you drop, you know, 2, 3, 5, 10, whatever the number is, £1,000 or dollars, then that can be quite effective. And in fact, it strikes me that given the volume of data, and you talked about this earlier, right? The sort of the data that you guys are able to now kind of show in terms of the rounds that are being completed on platform, but also, you know, what terms are favorable, what terms aren't. Given that volume of data that you've got on these early stage ventures, plus the fact that you are closing such a significant number of those deals on the platform, to me, at the very least, an obvious thing to do would be to start a fund and to invest in those, in the best deals that come across the table, right? But you haven't. Is that by choice? Are you biding your time? Are you simply just not interested in going down that route?
Great question. So I think one of the key issues, you know, we're a legal tech platform and, you know, it's a back-end service. We don't need to be FCA regulated. But once you start getting into matchmaking and a few other things, it becomes an FCA regulated area. That comes with its own challenges and its own timeline. But the short answer to your question is, maybe I think Reid Hoffman said it when somebody asked about how to get LinkedIn, you know, which is a great network. But what happens when you start with few people? And the idea is you first build a utility and then you build a network. So I guess watch the space.
Wow, that was saying lots without saying anything. Thank you for that, Anthony. I think I know exactly what you're saying. Listen, you're a technologist at heart with multiple patents under your belt. And when I think about technology, it should be about simplifying the complex. And we talked about that earlier, as well as creating kind of replicable processes that make something cheaper, faster, better for users. It kind of feels like at the moment we're seeing less of that kind of innovation. And maybe it's just that I, you know, there's a lot of noise out there and that's what gets elevated. But where are you hopeful for the value that technology can create? And, you know, where are you concerned at the moment? Where do you see things going?
Well, you know, it's a kind of distributed problem. There are thousands, tens of thousands of people, often called founders or their CTOs or their team or whatever. And they're all thinking about what can we do? Sometimes they simply have an idea. They've got a pain point. Oh, it was so painful getting insurance on my house or finding a bicycle repair place, whatever it might be. There's some pain point. Sometimes it's much more scientifically mission, profit, market segment driven. And so there are endless numbers of ideas. So perhaps what's being transformed is firstly the access to capital, and people investing on different risk reward bases make it easier than ever to start a startup. It's more democratized, you know, getting an idea, getting investment is easier. But maybe, and just maybe, as somebody who's been around for a while, I'm not a crypto native. And so you're always wondering, I'm sure there were investment bankers from the 70s going, these new startup rounds are insane. Why would someone give money without, you know, 400 pages of due diligence and warranties? There's no way I would. But actually, the ecosystem works great. But now, the current generation might be going, you mean you'll pay for the rights to this digital image that you sort of own, but everyone else has access to? That seems insane. So the whole NFT piece is a whole new language to learn, a whole new way of thinking, and a whole new way of assessing what is value. And I think this is quite interesting because I think it's challenging many people. Web3 takes it even to the next level. So I don't really think it's about, well, sorry, maybe the interesting answer to your question is, ultimately, I think the businesses that thrive are the ones that provide value and utility to their users. Otherwise, it's a bit of a vanity project. The question is, when there is something that comes completely from left field and nowhere, does and seemingly at first glance, like NFTs or Web3 or something, doesn't provide that value, do you ignore it? Do you embrace it? Or do you sort of slowly get there? And it's quite interesting because one of a couple of my patents from many years ago, from 20 or more years ago, are around distributed value using not blockchain. It was a sort of precursor. So back in Quasar days, could you give people points for doing things in a zero knowledge, no central database, a cryptographically robust system that you could accrue points or value for doing some action, a bit very much like, you know, creating Bitcoin, but without a central server. It was just way ahead of its time. But now I see essentially Web3 trying to replicate that same distributed model. But having been around a while, I saw what did and didn't work back then. And I'm quite intrigued about what will and won't work this time. Will things not work for the same reason they didn't before? Or is the timing everything and it suddenly reaches this popular zeitgeist and everyone's aware of it and everyone wants their ape and suddenly it goes ape. So, yes.
So, a bit of a reference there to the Bored Ape Yacht Club, I think, Anthony, which is an app for our listeners. If you're not into this, it's a non-fungible token or it's a minted non-fungible token, which people have purchased for quite extraordinary amounts of well, at the moment of crypto, although they may have cashed that out. There's a couple of points that you made there that I think are really important. One is, you know, around your comment around Quasar and what you'd done earlier, there's this whole kind of saying, I guess, that there's no such thing as a bad idea, only ideas that are too early. And I think we see cycles of that, right? So we saw that a little bit with artificial intelligence. Maybe we're seeing that, or we saw that earlier with crypto. There was obviously a massive blockchain craze in 2016-17, which faded away when it was becoming slightly more apparent that at the time there was no need for blockchain in the ventures that were being built. But again, as you say, it's very hard not to sit at the sidelines and just sort of you can throw your hands up in the air and say, well, it all seems like, you know, mumbo jumbo to me, but equally, I'm pretty sure, and we know most people did not expect to have a computer in their pocket in 2007, right? So I think, you know, as these platforms evolve, as these technologies evolve, and as, to your point, the utility becomes more clear, and I think that's the clear thing. When one strips away the noise of the ape or whatever it is and gets back to, well, what's the actual utility? What's the functionality that's happening? You know, you talked about smart contracts potentially on seed eagles in the future. Well, smart contracts are an absolutely core feature of, you know, of Ethereum and of blockchain technology. So I think, you know, absolutely. I think anyone who writes off any of these technologies as just being a bit kind of faddy maybe needs to beware a little bit, because, you know, these things could certainly kind of pass them by. Anthony, just before we wrap up, I'd love to understand from you, if you had one piece of advice for founders, and I know you've given loads of advice already today, but if you had to give one piece of advice for founders looking to build a venture right now, what would it be? And I'm going to assume they're going to come to Seed Legals to do their rounds, whatever else happens.
Thank you. I would have to repeat what I'd said before, which is, thing one is validate as far as you can that people really want it. And quite frequently, I see passionate founders coming to Seed Legals for their round, and they're convinced they want to solve a problem that's good for the planet, or they want to solve something for society, which is noble. And it's very, you know, sort of depressing in a sense, because you share the goal. It's a good for everybody. But unless people are actually going to want it and use it and pay for it, it's something that exists that really is unlikely to get traction. And you can see this where they're looking for high net worth individuals to invest, knowing they're not going to make a return on investment. But the high net worth individuals probably became high high net worth because they made astute investments. So either they seeing this as a sort of more semi-charity to give back to society and they dabbling in it, or you know, you're going to struggle. So it's really about figuring out and asking the right people, because, you know, otherwise 6 months or a year later, when you've built all this stuff and zero people are coming along and you're lying awake at night and you've got this horrible feeling about why nobody's coming, then you're going to remember, shit, I should have gone and done a bit more validation on it beforehand.
Sage advice, I think, for all of us. And even those of us who have been here before. I mean, I know, you know, we're in the middle of building product at the moment and we are just chafing at the bit to get it out into users' hands because we just know how important that validation is. We've had some validation, but there's nothing like real users. Anthony, I just want to thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you having come here and joined us on the podcast today. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where is the best online platform for them to come looking for you?
LinkedIn seems to be my sweet spot, and also on Twitter at Anthony Rose. And of course, if you've got any questions, just head over to seedlegals.com, hit the web chat button, and one of my team will be there to help with everything. Otherwise, hit up directly. You'll also find me in a few startup groups. Those tend to be closed, so it's probably less useful advice. But yes, whatever I can help with, as always, please let me know.
Amazing. Thank you, Anthony. Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.